Okay, so we're going to go to healing shame number two, and that is working on increasing worthiness. So how do you build self-esteem and sense of worthiness? I'm going to suggest a gratitude journal is a great thing to do. But you can have bouts of this. I don't know that a gratitude journal is something you want to do permanently or constantly, but you can decide you're going to do it for February or, you know, July or whatever. So I think a gratitude journal for a specific period of time serves a purpose. I think without a specific period of time, it tends to kind of be a bit hit and miss. I'm pretty sure that allocating rewards should be at the top of the list in terms of number one. And that is, how are you going to treat yourself kindly? What are the treats you're going to give yourself? What are you going to reward yourself with because you've reached a goal or done a target or, you know, persevered or whatever it is? And for most people, learn to say no is going to be a critical factor, because when we don't say no when we should, then, you know, and typically what I'm talking about there is saying no to additional responsibility. You know, can you please be the president or the treasurer or the secretary? Perhaps you could be all three of our local thing. Most of us struggle to say no to those things because they're worthy causes and the people who are asking need the help and all that sort of stuff. But the reality is, when we don't say no when we should say no, then what we're doing is we're putting ourselves last and we're saying these other things need more consideration than I do. And if you lead a full life, which you guys do, then there's a good chance that saying no is actually going to be the thing that most determines the quality of your life going forward. And the more things you say no to, I'm fond of, I think it's Warren Buffett who says, say no to everything and then reconsider.
Yeah,
I think that's, is it Warren Buffett?
I'm not sure. Yeah. It's a good idea.
It's a great idea. Say no to everything and then reconsider. As a methodology, as an approach, as a philosophy, it's likely to see you in good stead, likely to look after you rather than anything else. And then for most people, designing and using a mantra is a really, really powerful thing to do. And we talked the other day, Johnny, about your mantra, and what was it again? It was
I can achieve anything I set my mind to, and I am worthy of all that the universe has to offer.
Yeah,
and we've got to change the second part of that. I've got to change the second part of that, because it's about, you know, the underlying thing about there is that you need to deserve something, and you don't need to deserve it. It's just, it comes to you if it's going to come to you.
Yes. Yes. It's a strange concept that we feel like if we deserve it, we're more entitled.
Yeah.
And more entitled is the wrong thing. Mm. So a mantra is a really, really cool thing to develop. You guys have heard mine. So the reason I don't repeat mine, the reason I don't get my mantra out there too much is there's far more value in designing your own than there is, you know, copying mine or anybody else's. And so they're critically good things to do. Any thoughts, comments, or ideas on that?
So one thing for me, Paul, learning to say no, moving towards life after full-time work, you hear so many stories of people that give up full-time work and then they've never been as busy in their life as they after they get. They don't know how they would have fitted work in. So, yeah, I mean, I've got to make sure that I leave time for living and not just get tied up in doing stuff all the time.
I think it's critically important that you take the time now. I think you've got a big advantage, 19 or 20 months before retirement. There's plenty of time to be considering what you want your life to look like.
Yeah.
And I think if you don't design it, you'll end up with whatever happens.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I've already started on that journey as well. What it might look like. You know, 12 months seeing Australia that I've never seen, and you know, taking Kalesi on the journey, and then going live of all places, going live in Fiji. Goodness, you know, tough life.
Yeah. Tough life. Yeah. So you're gonna be a grey man, nomad, and travel around Australia
maybe for 12 months. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
you know, started looking at little pop-top caravans and looking at financing and stuff like that, and renting this place out and using the money from here to travel around Australia. And then when we get back, when we've done the full circle, then look at when do we move to Fiji.
Cool.
We're going to have a much better life in Fiji. I mean, it's all relative. Reading an article the other day that they've just done a study on poverty in Fiji, and nearly 30% of the population is in poverty. And you're not in poverty in Fiji if you're earning as an adult more than $2,100 a year. That's a pretty low bar to, you know, but they're saying that this is pre-COVID, so they're saying after last year, it will probably get worse because their whole economy was just decimated. So, you know, the difference we can have taking my superannuation money from Australia and living in Fiji, totally different lifestyle.
And it's powerful. Completely.
Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah.
Well, basically, all you've got to do is figure out how to live on less than what the super delivers.
Well, that's right. And it's easier to do in Fiji because Kalesi's living on about $10,000 a year that I send her, and that keeps the whole house going. So, my super is going to be a hell of a lot more than that in Fiji. So we can have a decent life in Fiji.
Cool. So my recommendation here is that those are the broad brushstrokes, and what you'll need to do next is go, okay, so what does a day look like? You know, because that's where we can run into trouble. You can kind of go, okay, I've moved here to Fiji, or even 12 months in Australia. It's kind of like, you know, it can go up in smoke and you don't know what happened because things will happen, things will occur. So it's a ridiculous example, but that's why a lot of people take up golf, you know, is kind of like but perhaps they've always wanted to do it. I can't think of something more ridiculous, but but the person who says I'm going to play golf three times a week actually has an advantage because that's three time slots that they have blocked out in their diary. And if they're playing Monday, Wednesday and Friday, well, those are three time slots where these extraneous activities can't burrow their way in and make themselves important because you're not even there. You're out of the house. And so people can't turn up and say, you know, can you give us a hand with this? Or can you do this for us or do that for us because you're not even there? So I think you've got the broad brushstrokes covered, and you'd start to look at, okay, so what's gonna uplift my spirit that I do that I'm gonna block some time out for?
Yeah.
And things like, you know, painting lessons or guitar lessons or golf or squash, they have to be coordinated with whoever's giving the lesson. And it's a strange thing, but as human beings, we respond extraordinarily well to formality of systems. You know, I've got to be at my guitar lesson at 10 o'clock on Mondays. Makes you go and do it. And that's actually what creates a quality of life is, you know, because if you're not having the lessons, the guitar and you sit at home getting around to it.
Yeah.
And the guitar gets covered in dust and you wonder what's happened.
Yeah.
So think about that.
I mean, you're an old woodwork teacher. One of the things I'd love to do in Fiji is find one of the native carvers, carvers as in wood carvers, not carver as in the drink, and get them to teach me how to carve.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that can be quite meditative.
Yeah.
You know, just sitting there carving a, you know, a carver bowl or something like that. And
Yes. It's surprising what things are therapeutic. Mm. And you would have heard me talk about laying bricks at our house. You know, 30 years ago when I'm building the house. And I discovered that laying bricks could be a therapeutic exercise. It could also be a pain in the ass, right? So it's very influenced by the attitude we bring to it. And the days when I was laying bricks, when I was in a hurry and wishing it would all be over, those were hard days.
Yeah.
the days where I approached it a little more slowly and a little more casually and kind of was looking for the adventure and took a little bit of extra time mixing up the mud and, you know, wandered around getting all the bricks in place first and, you know, just simple things that on the surface don't seem to be a big deal. But what they did was that they meant that I could just disappear into the work once it started.
Yeah.
And I would absolutely guarantee you carving will be the same thing.
Yeah.
Where I ran into trouble was when I wanted the result. So the process, what I noticed is the process is what delivered. But the days when I was counting how many bricks I laid, that's when it wasn't delivering.
Yeah.
So, you know, and, you know, depending on what you do, those kind of things. Yeah. You still got it in mind to do the sawmill thing?
Look, that still sits at the back of my mind, but it's probably a money thing, and if the money works out, then I would certainly look at going ahead with it. And it's interesting because that whole business probably would have been shut down due to COVID.
Yep.
Because there's been no building, but I mean, you could have still been cutting the timber and stacking it ready. But that's still at the back of my mind. And the thing that is at the back of my mind is that if the money is there, I will go ahead and do it, because we didn't go ahead with it, and Suli and his family have not had the opportunity to have financial freedom, because nobody else helped them to do it, which is what they promised to do. So I would just go ahead and not worry about what anybody else said and just go ahead and do it. So it's still very much in the back of my mind.
All right. So what I'd recommend is that, because nobody else knows what we're talking about, what I'd recommend is you explore crowdfunding.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
I would think that you could mount a successful crowdfunding campaign.
Yeah.
And that could be the thing that sorts it.
Yeah, okay.
I know a couple who lost their house in the bushfires in Canberra in 2003, and they had no insurance, so they were left with a block of land that was worth 300 grand, but they owed the bank 600 grand, and there was no way they could get going. So what they did was that they did a crowdfunding campaign to build the house. They needed about 300,000. They raised 480. So they gave the other 180 to somebody else.
Yeah.
And in that process, realised that they were having more fun than they'd ever had in their entire lives. And since then, they have basically spent their life crowdfunding for projects and various specific things.
That's a good
idea. I like that idea. Yeah, it's kind of like fun to turn up and give people money. Especially when we spend our lives working to get it, and then we discover a new way to get it and go, oh, you can have some. Oh, yeah. What do you need? All right, I'll get you some. It's kind of like, would do wonders for your money mindset thing, etc.
Yeah, I like that idea.
Just something to explore. All right, let's move on to next thing. In terms of healing shame, probably the main thing for most people is avoiding perfectionism. And there's a way of looking at this, and I suppose this is probably addressed more at Sarah. And those of you who are listening who've been touched with the perfectionism brush, then what you can do is you can change the wording, you can change the concept, you can change the approach that you take to something and dramatically change its impact on you. So what perfectionism really is it's a shield from being judged and being shamed. We kind of talked about that, you know, how, you know, really it's kind of like a self-protection mechanism that keeps judgment one step apart. So we know that that's one aspect of perfectionism. If you can change it into, all right, well, let's just use whatever I'm doing as a stepping stone for improvements towards some goals, then we're taking a need and the neediness associated with it and turning it into a preference. and or a challenge. And as soon as it goes from need to preference or challenge, it changes its impact on us in terms of how we relate to it. Is this making sense to you, Sarah?
Yes.
Cool. Because ultimately, perfectionism does more damage to the owner of the perfectionism than it does to anybody else. You know, so perfectionists suffer from that. So if we can shift what's going on, what it means is you can still go after excellent performance. You can still go after superb delivery. You can still go after the things that, you know, you can get a lot of satisfaction in doing really, really well. But if you looked at it as a challenge rather and a challenge for self rather than a need, then it changes the focus of the whole thing. Perfectionism also revolves around what other people think of us. And in fact, perfectionism is the attempt to manipulate what other people think of us by trying to get a perfect result so that they will think positively about us. If we can change the focus of that to, well, how do I improve? What do I need to do better? You know, sitting down and doing a review of either a performance or a behavior or a project or whatever it is, and then saying, okay, so how could I do that better? What approach would be different? You know, what skills should I do if I had my time again? Those kind of things. Then once again, that moves us away from the external focus on other people to the internal focus on ourselves and what we can do to change things. And that's a pretty healthy thing to do. Of course, perfectionism is self-destructive in the way that we've described it. It has some good sides to it, you know. It does get people to strive, but it puts unnecessary pressure on because of the way it's delivered. Inevitably, it leads to self-blame. In other words, you know, it's, I didn't do it well enough, and, you know, it just gets ugly. If we can shift that into, well, actually, I'm okay. Nobody's perfect in terms of what they deliver, but we're perfect in terms of who we are. So I can accept who I am. And, you know, acceptance is a big concept. Acceptance is a profound and deep concept that not many people understand. And that is the idea that I can accept myself as I am, warts and all. And of course, when I say this to clients, you know, most clients say to me, what? And I go, you need to accept yourself, warts and all. And they go, okay, good, but how do I get the warts off? It's kind of, yes, I understood, but how do I get rid of these warts? Okay, those warts are part of who you are. So self-acceptance is a deep concept because most people figure that they understand what it is and they can accept themselves as soon as they change, as soon as they become different. So what we have to do is start to value our differences. And that's where Mary's and my relationship took off. Was that, you know, way back when we were clashing and we realized what we were doing was we were arguing about the differences between us instead of treasuring the differences between us. And as soon as we started to treasure the differences between us, then things got easy because each of us was feeling more appreciated by the other. So that's the feeling that, okay, your behavior is not perfect, but you, of course you are. Perfectionism is, generally speaking, if not just a pathway to anxiety, definitely it's going to go, if it goes past anxiety, which is what most people suffer from. If you said to me, what is the fastest growing problem in our culture in the last 5 to 10 years, I'd say anxiety. I would have said fear a while back, but I think the fear has kind of morphed into background anxiety, an anxiousness about what's the unpredictability of life. I think COVID has done wonders for the people who've been able to cope with it. You know, there are a lot of people being liberated by the idea we can't predict what's going to happen tomorrow, so let's be a little bit more free and easy. But it's wounded a lot of people who have gone, I don't know what's going to happen, so I'm hunkering down and going into my shell. So hunkering down and going into your shell can be a kind of a life paralysis kind of concept. A better way to look at it is to say, okay, there's a path to fulfillment and joy here. If I let being a perfectionist just morph into the desire to accept challenges and to accept the results of those challenges, then I can joyfully go about my path. It's kind of like, you know, I can, you know, we're about to embark on another renovation. I can do that renovation and be stressed and pressured because of the two major constraints that are around renovations, and that is the amount of money available and the amount of time to get it done in. Those two things, either one of those two things by itself will create pressure. Put them together, and generally speaking, there's your typical building project. So that we can do that project with plenty of stress and pressure, and that has an impact on us. My time frame for this renovation is probably 12 months. So that's 12 months of pressure. Or we could do it joyfully. Either way, we're going to end up with the renovation done. Either way, it's going to go over budget and over time. Either way, it's an opportunity for joy and laughter, or an opportunity for struggle and pain. And it'll be us that make that distinction. Okay, so that's that one. This all comes from work done by Brené Brown in what she calls the gifts of imperfection. She says our imperfections are actually gifts. Any questions, thoughts, words, or comments on that before we move on?
All makes sense.
Makes sense to you, John? Sarah?
Yeah, I've written down value my warts.
Yeah, valuing your warts. Warts is so not a good...
Yeah.
Warts doesn't create a nice picture.
That works for me better than a gratitude journal.
Yeah. Okay. Just accept that the way that we are and our uniqueness is a gift. You know, it is a gift to everybody it's a gift to everybody who can see it as a gift. And that's really the kind of, you know, you could almost describe the process of life as that, you know, is that we all have these unique gifts. We walk around wearing them or demonstrating them. People move towards us or away from us depending on their capacity to identify those gifts or not. And when they see them not as gifts, but they see them as pains in the ass, then they move away from us. When they identify them as gifts, they move towards us. And so it's people coming towards us is a question of them recognizing the uniqueness and specialness of us. People moving away from us is them incapable of seeing the value to them. Not about us, not about, you know, we don't need to change so that those people who are moving away from us stop moving away from us. Okay, number four.
Can I just add something to that? I think, my brain's going in overdrive at the moment. I think that part of that is then to, like, the recognizing of those warts as your gifts is healing your own, like number one, the your own self that's shaming your own yourself.
Yes.
I think part B of that, because then the next reaction was, well, then, you know, that's not fair. They're not recognizing or valuing my gifts, and so therefore they're going away from you. But then there's the the next part of that is to understand that if they're not recognizing them, they're not people who you need in your day.
In fact, it's really good that they're moving away from you.
yeah, which is the next level of that, yes.
Yeah, we don't recognize how good that is that they're moving away. You know, the reality is, you know, it's a frightening concept to think that we change our behavior so that people won't abandon us. But
but
the problem is the people who don't abandon you because you modified your behavior, they don't know who you are.
Yeah.
We're surrounded by people who bought a story. Right? So we should be expecting them to leave at any time, because once they find out the truth, they're likely to leave.
They'll leave anyway.
Yeah. But what it means is we're surrounded by people who bought a story. So how can we have respect for someone that we gave a snow job to? It's a staggering concept to think that, you know, I've got a bunch of people around me who are only there because I've manipulated how they feel about me. Therefore, they're a bit dumbass, right? They bought the story. So I'm surrounded by idiots.
Oh dear. You don't like it, cry.
How am I going to love and respect these people who bought this bullshit that I sold?
Yeah.
Yeah, ridiculous. Let's move on from that.
Please. You're throwing my head in. Yeah, it's all good.
Okay, so number four is making a decision. And this is probably the most difficult thing for people to grasp or to kind of wrap their brain around, and that is that we can actually just decide to accept ourselves, warts and all, and that's gonna nail the shame. Because once I accept to myself, warts and all, then what happens is all of my shameful words and deeds from the past just don't matter anymore. So self-acceptance is kind of like the bottom line in making progress with shame. So you have to start thinking that you're enough, that you're good enough, that you are enough, as you are right now. Not that you're improving into being acceptable. That makes sense to you guys?
Yeah, raises a question for me, which we talked about before, about me going back into the past and looking at, you know, previous things where I've, you know, that have caused me shame and bringing them into the future. For all of us, there's probably stuff back there that most people don't know about other than us.
Yeah.
And stuff happens and it triggers. And what happens if people find out about the stuff that might be in our past? Is it that you develop so much self-acceptance that you accept the fact of what happened in the past might have been wrong at the time, but you've grown and moved on and that's not you anymore?
Well, what I see in workshops is quite strange but quite humbling. I described to you guys before, every now and then in a live workshop, someone will say, there's something I want to get off my chest, and they come up the front and they talk about something they said or did. That's usually done. They're usually shaking like a leaf when they're doing it because they're going through the fear of being rejected, but they've arrived at the point where they realize I can't live with it anymore, that it's a part of their every waking moment, and so they've got to do something. And having discovered they're in a safe place, they're willing to take the risk. But what I see when they stand on the stage facing the crowd and they're about to spill the beans is that they are petrified. They are literally terrified. And they somehow get through it anyway, which is, you know, if you stop and think about that, that's enormous courage. So they speak it out. Sometimes we have to sit around waiting for them to finish a sentence that they don't want to put the last word on because that actually says what happened and blah, blah, blah. And so there is usually stunned silence, which is agonizing for the person who is talking. So usually at that stage, I will step in and I will say to the crowd, what this person has just done is stood up here and made themselves enormously vulnerable. They're convinced, they're absolutely certain that you're going to hate them from here on in. So what, because they have demonstrated the courage to speak up, they deserve your frank and honest opinion. So I want you to tell the absolute truth now about how you feel about this person. Don't hold back, because they deserve the honesty. So hands up and we'll go from there. So someone will stick their hand up and I'll say, okay, Fred, what do you want to say to the person who was just confessed, so to speak? And without a doubt, it's always, I admire you more because I see the courage that it took to do that. And now I have a greater respect for you because the sheer strength and courage to get that out on the table, you know, I respect that. I wish I had the strength that you have. I say, okay, thanks, Fred. Who else? And, you know, it doesn't matter how many people we ask. It'll all be the same kind of feedback. The person standing on the stage goes through enormous relief. And that's when they're actually freed from the thing they've been carrying. is when they realise that people who had the opportunity to judge didn't, and that all their life they've been keeping these other people at arm's length, and these are the people who haven't been given the chance to judge. And the owner of the thing has been doing the judging on behalf of the crowd, so to speak. Is this making sense?
Yep.
So, in essence, when I said to you that stuff in your past, John, if you just journal it, and I, as I said, in the form of a letter is probably the best way, then what you're doing is exactly the same thing. You're bringing it out into the open and saying, oh, I'm admitting to this happening. I'm taking responsibility for it as well. So, you know, there might be some apologies I want to make. There might be some actions I want to, you know, there may be nothing, but, you know, but as a consequence of that, this is a new position that I'm in. What we're doing is we're saying I'm not keeping it a secret anymore. I'm owning the feelings associated with that. And whilst there isn't the opportunity for anybody to judge me because of it, there is still a revelation. Because when I get a skeleton and put it in the closet, that's to hide it from you guys. But the reality is, there's one person I want it most hidden from. And that's me. And therefore, that's why that journaling will work, is because what you're doing is you're saying, okay, I'm going to face it.
Yeah.
I'm going to step up to the plate and I'm going to deal with what comes up. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Cool. That makes sense, Sarah?
Yeah.
It's kind of like it's an act of faith, right? Because you're saying, I don't know how I'm going to feel. I'm pretty sure this is going to be ugly, but I'm going there anyway. That's an act of faith that says, you know, I know that I will get through it. And in essence, as a coach, what I'm saying to you is you can have a reasonable level of confidence you will get through it because I'm saying other people have done it. You will still feel afraid yourself. You will still feel go through all the emotions yourself. You still have to do all that work yourself. But as you know, as we keep saying, all personal development takes place between your ears, not mine. I can't actually deliver it.
Yeah.
You're the one who delivers it. So those actions, it's simply a matter of scheduling them. I've found that when I need to do work like that, there's usually a week or 10 days of farting around and not getting to it. And then Mary says, have you done that work you said you're going to do? And I go, no. And she goes, when are you going to do it? And I go, Wednesday. And she goes, okay. And she doesn't say like by when or any of that kind of stuff. But as soon as I say Wednesday, then I realize, okay, Wednesday afternoon, I'm going to spend a bit of time doing that. And it's always enormously healing, but I always approach it with enormous reluctance. So, you know, the two things that I can count on is that there's enormous reluctance and there's enormous breakthrough.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, maybe a year or two ago, Mary and Julie were down at the farm and I was up here on the Gold Coast by myself for a couple of weeks. And probably one of the biggest breakthroughs of my entire life took place in that couple of weeks because I committed to doing some of that kind of work, and it was mostly with pen and paper, and I committed to having it done before they got back. And that meant that there was the usual reluctance, but I managed to get into it, and I was able to do a bit each day because I knew that that 2 weeks was my healing 2 weeks. It was kind of in my mind that 2 weeks was, oh, I'm going to get my shit together while they're not here, and you know, I have my day to myself to run for myself so I can decide when and how and all that sort of stuff. So it's an opportunity that I could have missed or I could have taken. A bit like COVID. It's been an opportunity that people could miss or take.
Yeah.
And they either, mm-hmm. people in COVID got fatter or they got fitter. There's only one of those two. Okay. So when we get to the deeper levels, then the big question is, okay, what can we do about this? How can we move forward with this? And I think I've lost a slide there somewhere. Oh, yeah, so you guys see that. So the high-level question is, how do we fix it? What do we do? What is the cure? So So remember I said the low-level question was what causes it? Why have I got it? The high-level question is what is a cure? So despite the fact I've talked about three things before, I've talked about four strategies so far. Those are about healing shame. They will work on shame regardless of whether you're working on imposter syndrome or not, because shame quite often extends beyond imposter syndrome. If we go to, okay, what do we do to heal imposter syndrome? There's six or seven or eight strategies coming up now. So first one is acknowledgement. This is a fairly straightforward kind of a concept. It's simply acknowledging that you are thinking that way, rather than getting into a fight with it, rather than engaging with it and wrestling with it like a crocodile. You know, in fact, this is like a giant octopus. Imposter syndrome kind of slithers all over you and gets you from every angle. You can never get all the legs off at once. So really what I'm saying is if you observe the thought as an observer, then what happens is that it doesn't get a grip on you. And because it doesn't get a grip on you, there's a chance for you to acknowledge that it is the way that it is, but it doesn't have to be your truth. So we need to go and more critically question those thoughts about I'm an imposter or I'm not good enough or whatever. And the major question is, does that help me or hinder me? Okay, so that's the most important question. Does that thought help me or does that thought hinder me? Is this making sense, Sarah?
Yep.
Cool. You onto that, Johnny?
Yep.
Rightio. So that's a fairly this is a really simple process that gets you to Tony Robbins would call this a pattern interrupt. Instead of feeling like an imposter, observe that you're feeling like an imposter, and then ask yourself, well, is that moving me forward or is that not? Fairly straightforward kind of a situation. Strategy number two is perhaps, you know, well, this would be in my top three personal development strategies of all time, and that's a concept of reframing. And really what that does is that reframing says we can look at the same circumstances differently and frame them up differently to how they are at the moment. So from that point of view, the only difference between someone who experiences imposter syndrome and someone who doesn't is how they respond to challenges. So when it comes to challenges, then we've kind of got to look at the idea that people who don't feel like imposters are no more intelligent or they're no more competent, they're no more capable than anybody else. It just means that we have to learn to think like a non-imposter. Thinking like a non-imposter means understanding how I have to think to go beyond the hesitation that imposter syndrome brings up. Because when we suffer from imposter syndrome, the biggest consequence of it is hesitation, which turns into procrastination. So hesitation turning into procrastination, many of us are sitting ducks for that. You know, many of us have got lots of experience of procrastinating for longer than we wanted to about stuff that we didn't need to, and it comes from hesitating rather than going, okay, what is there a different way to look at that? That makes sense to you guys?
Yep.
Yep. Any questions on that one?
No.
You good with that, Sarah?
Yeah. Sorry, you didn't hear me.
You're right. I'm just kind of checking that you're with me. Okay. Now, strategy number three, Breakfast of Champions, is feedback. So it was the first thing that hit me like an express train when I was working at the Institute of Sport, is that every athlete wanted to hear where they were going wrong. It was kind of like their modus operandi. It was just kind of the thing that they wanted to know today was, which bit am I messing up? Because when they could, you know, they actively went looking for, and they would sit people like me down and say, what am I doing wrong? Where am I going haywire? It's a rare thing for people to do, particularly if you're running a team like John is. The chances are someone in your team, it comes to you and says, where am I going wrong, are minimal, because they're afraid that if you see that they're going wrong and that you will judge their performance and their behavior and all those sort of things, and they're not totally equipped to handle that. But if we can demonstrate that, and it sounds to me like both of you guys do demonstrate that. What it means is you will continuously, you will value criticism and you will actively seek that criticism so that you can improve your own performance. And by improving your own performance, you demonstrate that to everybody else. Fundamental to that is understanding that you're not a finished product yet. Fundamental to understanding that is knowing that you're going to be better next year than you are this year, that there's plenty of room for improvement. You could be actually hitting it out of the park, but there's still room for improvement. And reminding yourself that any skill, to remain a skill, has to be practiced. And so, you know, the reason we say, if you ever could ride a bike, you'll always be able to ride a bike. But it might be hairy the first day you get back on after 20 years. The skill doesn't go, but it might need brushing up. So if we understand that we have to practice the skill of getting feedback, then what, you know, because it's not natural to us to walk around looking for feedback, then we don't remember to practice it. And it's practicing it that actually makes it a part of our life, so that it becomes habitual rather than when you remember. Make sense?
Yep.
Questions, thoughts, or anything on that?
Just on the fact that till the day we die, we'll always be a work in progress.
Yeah.
And I hope to be learning up until the day I die.
Yes, because otherwise it's kind of like you're a finished product. No wonder you're going to die. Yeah, you've got a plan for how long you're living, haven't you, John?
I want to see my 100th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
I've not counted down how many days it is for a while, but it's about 12,000 and something days to my 100th birthday.
Uh-huh, cool. Have you thought about that, Sarah?
I have a really different perspective. I should have been dead before I was 20, so I'm on overtime already.
You're on overtime, yeah.
I don't know.
I'm on overtime as well.
I'm not afraid of dying, and I'm sort of half looking forward to it, but in a funny sort of way as well, but that's just a belief thing. If I'm not, like I said earlier, you know, bring on the challenge. If I'm not improving something or fixing something or thinking about something or working on something, then, you know, I'm going backwards. I'm bored.
Makes sense. So I haven't got a specific end date in mind, but I do want to go way past 90. I've got the genetics for it from my mum and dad. They've gone into their 90s. And I'm a big believer in the maintaining fitness and health well into your 90s and 100s. So that gives me focus on this work in progress, in as much as I was just saying to Julie about an hour ago that I got an increase. The weights that I lift in the gym have been the same since last August. So, you know, when I do a bicep curl, the most I can manage is 10 kilos. And that's been that way since August. And I've been very interested in not injuring myself. But this morning I managed 12 kilos, so a big breakthrough. And, you know, when I think about it, who cares? What does it matter? And what's the difference? Except that it might add some years to my life because that impacts bone density and a bunch of other things as well. But that desire to improve, that desire to understand we're a work in progress and we can always be better, is a critically important thing for us to get a hold of. And, of course, we've got to practice. Okay. It's time for us to grab a cup of tea, those kind of things, come back and do our final session. So,
cool.
Let's take the break. Starting now. Ready, set, go.